Hello, welcome to the Roxburgh House Roundtables. Today we have a very special roundtable dealing with neurodiversity with some very important experts in the field who hopefully will address some issues that you have or answer some questions you have on this topic. We are very honored to have Dr. Wendy Ross as our moderator. She's a developmental and behavioral health pediatrician who in 2009 founded a nonprofit organization called Autism Inclusion Resources. In 2014, Dr. Ross was among the finalists for CNN's Hero of the Year program that honors everyday people changing the world. She created Autism Inclusion Resources as a vehicle for preparing families with autistic children for community experiences and preparing communities for experiences with those affected by autism. Dr. Ross is now director of the Center for Autism and Neurodiversity at Jefferson Health. At the Center for Autism and Neurodiversity, their mission is to be a thought leader and creative force behind interdisciplinary solutions that enable individuals with autism and other neurodiverse conditions to participate more fully in the world at large. Thank you, Dr. Ross, for coming today. I hand it over to you.
Evan, thank you so much for having us. We're so excited to be here today. I am going to be talking about autism and neurodiversity with this amazing group. And the first thing I just wanted to mention is to sort of explain neurodiversity is came out of the autism community, and it really has been expanded as a term to refer to anyone who really has trouble or struggles or challenges with communication, social skills, sensory issues, or behaviors. And so what we're going to be talking about today is sort of neurodiversity that is in the university and in the healthcare system, and how many of us are working to make both of these systems more neurodiverse friendly. So I am, as Evan said, the inaugural director of the Center for Autism and Neurodiversity at Jefferson. And from my team, I have Jane Tobias, who's a nurse practitioner, and Mike Barrett, who's our director of occupational therapy. And then I'm really privileged to have here from the Goals 2 program at the university, Ashley Seaver, and also a third year doctoral OT student, Kate Saylor, today. So just to get us started, I was hoping, Ashley, you could talk to us about what is the Goals 2 program and how it helps students.
Great. Thanks, Wendy. Thanks so much for that introduction. So the Goal Squared program is a free program offered to students at Jefferson University, where we provide occupational therapy services to students who are experiencing, the range of neurodiversity or disability spectrum in the university. When students are in high school, there are a lot of services that are available that are mandated by the government for them to receive in order to support them throughout their education. But by the time those students transition to college, those supports are no longer mandated. So we see a lot of students who enter university used to a certain level of support, and then suddenly they're in a new environment that's oftentimes more challenging with more expectations and less support. And so our program was designed to really add an extra layer of services to those individuals when they enter university and throughout their university experience that works with them on really like a guided self-discovery that helps them to really explore what it is that they want to do and how they can do it.
Sorry, Kate, can you talk to us a little bit about your experience at the university?
Yes, so I'm completing my doctoral capstone here at Goal Square, and it's been a really interesting experience for me personally because I actually have ADHD, and I get to work with clients as well who are in the spectrum of neurodiversity. So I get to work with clients to help them figure out what their goals are, what their desires are, and then make plans focused on those goals. And it's been really personally rewarding because I get to bring my own lived experience as well as the OT experience and expertise.
That's really great. Thank you for sharing that with us. Jane, can you talk to us a little bit more about the Center for Autism Neurodiversity and some of the projects that we're working on?
Sure. Hi, everyone. My name is Jane Tobias, and I am a assistant professor in the Jefferson College of Nursing. And clinically, I am a pediatric nurse practitioner in primary care. Our work at the Center for Autism and Neurodiversity really focuses around creating inclusive programs, both throughout the university setting, our enterprise setting, and also the surrounding communities in Philadelphia. We have worked extensively in educating all the healthcare professionals in the different clinics and programs, as well as the security departments at Jefferson Health, and really just bringing an awareness to, you know, this community that we're so passionate about caring for, and that's the community of those with neurodiversity. Those invisible disabilities that, you know, we don't see, but that most of us sometime in our lifetime will be affected by. And part of our success, I believe, is that we're an interprofessional team at the center. Nursing, I bring that nursing lens to the work we do. Mike Barrett is our occupational therapist, and his role is integral in the success of really creating pathways for people with neurodiversity. Dr. Ross is our director, who really has that high level view, that big picture view of where we're needed, where our work is needed. I'm going to ask Mike to talk a little bit about his role in the center, but really more specifically, the key role of an occupational therapist in creating these pathways for those with these invisible disabilities.
Thank you, Jane. And I will definitely do that, but I actually wanted to take just a quick minute to back up to something that I thought was really important that Kate actually mentioned and goes along with what Dr. Ross was saying a moment ago when she defined neurodiversity. So Kate brought up this notion of people with ADHD, and I think that's an important intersection to really focus on, because this notion of neurodiversity comes out of this realm of, as was said, autism and intellectual disabilities, developmental disabilities, but it really is so much broader than that. And it includes other things that people might not necessarily conceptualize in the same way. So things like ADD and ADHD, or even anxiety, depression. But really, we look at it, and this affects the way that all of our work happens, especially from an occupational therapy lens. We look at it in the biggest, broadest sense, where a person can be neurodiverse as a more permanent trait, that's something about them, but we also conceptualize it as something that can be this temporary state, can be this acquired thing that a person experiences for one reason or another. So to tie in the Goal Squared program, which I am actually a former student of that program. I actually was actually my supervisor at one point in time. So I can speak from a personal experience helping to provide services for that program, where a lot of students come into college experiences and experience a high level of stress. I think we're all familiar with stress and the way that it impacts and affects people. People affected by stress to a certain degree could be considered to have a temporary state of neurodiversity, particularly when we think about the way so many students seem to fall apart in their routines once midterms or finals come around and they need so much extra support, because in a temporary way, their thought patterns, their behaviors, their routines have been disrupted so much that their neurodiverse needs or their just cognitive needs change so much that you could define them that way. And this really extends to so many other states of being. So like a person experiencing grief, or a person undergoing a positive form of stress, like a person dealing with pregnancy and its many complications in that long period of time, could be considered neurodiverse. Or somebody in an acute crisis, like they've just been in a car accident, or really there's so much going on that could really affect the way that people think. And the reason why I tell that very long-winded explanation of these things is that really everyone can benefit from the different kinds of work that we do within the educational system, within the healthcare system, within the enterprise system, but also within the community, with the city, with different businesses. a big part of my role is taking a lot of time to explain that to people. I think a lot of people recognize that there's a lot of different people with a varied set of needs, with a varied set of resources. We have this growing understanding of a diversity of people these days. There's a lot more work to do, don't get me wrong. There's still a lot more understanding and empathy that we can seed and grow in the world. But as people start to look up and look around and recognize these things in other people, we find that a lot of people want to do something about it. They want to reach out. They want to understand how to work with other people. Businesses want to know how to attract more customers. Parents want to know how to relate to their kids. Teachers want to know how to work with the full spectrum of their students. But a lot of people don't know how. Unfortunately, we're at a point where a lot of people are talking about these things, but there's not necessarily a good guidepost that we can point people to. There's a lot of information, but there's not necessarily like a pamphlet I can hand to someone and say, here, look through this and you'll understand neurodiversity and how to address it and all of the contexts that are important to you. So a lot of what we do, because there's a lack of that, is try to make something like that, which is a long-term project. But we also try to give people, regardless of whatever context it is, that support. So that means going out and working with local businesses to help them figure out how to hire and support neurodiverse individuals. It means working with people with different departments on the Jefferson Health campus to understand how to meet the diverse needs of their clients so that they have a better patient experience. It means teaching classes. We actually teach a wide range of, I believe, 5 courses at this point, hopefully with more to come. Yes, Wendy's given me the 5 to let me know that I'm correct, to help students understand how they can take their interest in these things, in industrial design, in visual communication design, in medicine, in occupational therapy, soon speech therapy, and a range of others, how they can take those skills and leverage them to support these populations, and then have that support and effort branch out and benefit a much wider audience. I could, of course, go on and on and on and on about all of these things because it's literally my job, but I will cede some of the time back to my fellows here because I know there's a lot of people with important perspectives.
I was hoping, Ashley and Kate, you could talk to us, to Mike's point about the specific strategies that might benefit a student, either with ADHD or with autism as 2 examples. I mean, I know there's probably others, but I thought, if you could provide some examples of some of the, concrete strategies that you use.
Sure. Kate, I can start if that's okay. Do you want to speak? I'm sorry, we're in the same room, so we're working on our audio. Good. Can you all hear me?
Okay, you're good. Awesome. You're good.
Thanks. So just to jump off of Mike's point, I guess like my main takeaway from that and the way I really think about neurodiversity too is like, how do we even describe what is normal brain function to say what is divergent from it or what is diverse from it, right? Like, I really think about neurodiversity as like we all have a different brain and all of our brains work in different ways. And so we're all on the neurodiversity spectrum, like all of our brains think differently. And so our work in Goal Squared is really about kind of looking at a person and meeting them where they're at. I'll talk to Wendy's point about how specifically we do that. We really train our students who work in the program to think about empathy and what it means to be able to put yourself in someone else's shoes. How do you imagine that you are that person and what that lived experience would be like? And then we talk about how do we show our clients that we have empathy? So how do we build a relationship through listening out loud, listening in ways that show those people that we get it, we understand, and we're on their side? We talk a lot about how to build trust in relationships. So we talk a lot about positive regard for our clients and how we communicate to our clients that we see them as good and whole as they are. And then I guess from there, we build on that relationship by really helping our clients explore what it is that they want. We give them a lot of autonomy. We never tell our clients, you have to do this or you should do that. We ask them, what is it that you want to do? And then we help them think about how do you want to go about doing that? Like, what are the tools or strategies that you think would work? We really like to view our clients as the expert on themselves and that we're a partner or a guide that helps them to really develop their own expertise. And we do that for clients regardless of their diagnosis or what they're presenting with. So we really, sometimes it doesn't really matter to us if a client has autism or ADHD or depression or anxiety. We treat clients very similarly as people who are presenting to us that we're trying to understand.
Sorry, technical challenge. So absolutely, like what Ashley said, one of the biggest shifts, I think, in coming into this program is that we focus really on treating the client as the expert on themselves. And I think in healthcare, especially whenever a clinician walks into the room, we have the assumption that we are the expert and that they are the person who is being helped. And so as clinicians, whenever working with neurodivergent populations, or really, I think, really this could span across healthcare. Whenever you walk into a room, connect, show empathy, and allow the client to tell you what they need and then how they want to accomplish that, because that's where real change can happen. And that's where we can really assist them in getting to the goals that they want and the things that they need.
I think to that point, in our program at the Center for Autism and Neurodiversity, that's one of the first things that we always do. You know, we definitely take that philosophy, nothing about us without us, and see, you know, the patients as people and not diagnoses, right? And we always start each of our programs with a focus group, and we ask people to exactly what you guys are saying, sort of what they want and how they would like, you know, healthcare providers, for example, to treat them. And then we sort of take that information and we use it to educate the healthcare team, and not just the physicians or the nurse practitioners or the physician's assistants, because by the time you've gotten to that person, you've already, you know, touched others, right? Like you've scheduled an appointment, you've checked in, you've been in the waiting room. Like some of us are exhausted by the time we get through all that, right? So, and then we create resources, you know, based on our focus group input about what will help make an experience more accessible or enjoyable to them. And then lastly, we measure the outcomes, and we're really looking for a best practice. Because, you know, Ashley, what I heard you talking about is that when students transition from high school to college or university, they really have transitioned legally from special education law, which ends, to the Americans with Disabilities Act, which continues, right? And the Americans with Disabilities Act is over 30 years old. I think it's going to have its 32nd birthday. Although there are guidelines for physical disabilities, for example, like a ramp has to be at a certain incline. It's not like everybody can put up their own ramps, right? There are guidelines. There are literally no guidelines for neurodiversity. So that is sort of what we're hoping long-term to help drive with the data that we obtain. And I just want to add to Mike's point, it is true that when we program for the most vulnerable of us, we really do make things better for everybody, right? So for example, a ramp was created for wheelchairs, but benefits people with walkers and strollers or delivery dollies. So, and a lot of the strategies, for example, for ADHD really help all students that are taking that leap to college where you're required to have a lot more executive functioning of your own, right? So a lot of the things that we're talking about and what I hear everybody saying are really about how people should be treating each other regardless of a diagnosis, and speaks to the kind of care that some people really have to have, but that really, frankly, all of us probably deserve.
Go ahead. Sorry to interrupt. Is before we got too far away with it, I also wanted to add to, you know, this notion of ADA and accessibility comes up quite a bit in these conversations and in these projects. And one thing that I think often gets lost in the shuffle when discussing this law, this set of guidelines, is that it's not only, as Dr. Ross said, this minimum set of guidelines for like physical disabilities, but it's a minimum set of guidelines for accessibility. It's literally about getting people into spaces so that they can participate. But then what happens in those spaces is just left up in the air. So while it does have a lot of information about things like how wide a doorway should be and which direction it should open, and gives you a reason for why you should have a lever doorknob versus a rounded traditional doorknob, once you get inside that building, it really stops. And of course, there's a wide, incalculable number of contexts that happen inside of buildings that you couldn't necessarily regulate around. But it also kind of gets taken for granted as this like end all be all that really doesn't incorporate these other features. And then a great anecdote that I actually like to tell students exactly to Wendy's point about designing and creating and facilitating all of this function is that when we really consider these extreme cases, I do a lot of work with design students, particularly in Jefferson's industrial design department, and designing for these really extreme cases can be this powerful lesson that helps students understand how these things can really appreciate and benefit everyone. So one of the classic examples, and this is getting a little bit away from neurodiversity into the realm of physical disability, but for argument's sake, one of the classic examples would be a peeler. A Good Grips peeler by OXO was originally designed to accommodate for a person with arthritis. It has a large rubbery grip that indents slightly around where you do this grasp, this full-fisted grasp around it to accommodate your hands, because the original designer, his wife, was using a traditional wire metal peeler, which has very little surface area. You can't hold onto it, and thus you can't really use it to accommodate this range of hands, which are very diverse. My OT students can tell you they spend a lot of time just learning about the shapes and the forms of the hand and how that can be different. But it's this classic example of a product that we don't even think about anymore, because the old wire style of peeler really doesn't exist anymore. It's been completely supplanted by this universally designed peeler that just works better for everyone. Another example that maybe fewer people know about, also related to arthritis, is your keyboard. Your typewriter was originally made to accommodate a person with disabilities. Yet again, it was a person with arthritis where they were writing, a couple was writing love letters back and forth. And when one of them developed arthritis, at the time, there was no other way for them to accommodate writing their personal intimate thoughts down other than to dictate them to another person. And that doesn't really seem like the kind of thing you would want to go through a third party and then send to your spouse or lover. So they actually devised the typewriter as a way to manage a person's physical disability and still enable them to participate in society. And it's been such a successful adaptation that we don't think about it anymore. It helps everybody facilitate and do all sorts of things. It's literally used all over the world with variations to accommodate languages and even further variations to accommodate other sets of needs, both physical and cognitive or sensory. But it's just a great example of how doing these things well really benefits everyone. And that's the kind of full contextualized, fully thought out work that we try to do at the Center for Autism and Neurodiversity.
Thank you, Mike, for speaking about that. And also mentioning, you said something that really stuck in my mind, and that is the ADA. And we just really have the minimum amount of, you know, requirements for those with disabilities. And during the COVID pandemic, our population, our neurodiverse population, really felt the impact of it in terms of being able to access healthcare and being recognized as a priority population. Our team at Jefferson and at the Center for Autism and Neurodiversity conducted a research study where we looked at 64 million patients with IDD, I believe that's how high the number was, and found that they were three times as more likely to die from COVID. for various reasons, communication reasons, inability to let people know they weren't feeling well, inability to get to the hospital and seek care, or once they were even there, letting somebody know how sick they were and getting that higher level of care. It was really work research we did that we're so super proud of because it changed policy. It changed policy nationally. It changed policy internationally. And because of it, you know, at our center, we opened a vaccination clinic, several of them during the height of the pandemic when vaccine became available, and prioritized our population and were able to get not only them, their family members, their caregivers, because remember, they're part of a dyad or a triad. You know, this is the group they travel with. We have to make sure everybody stays well and healthy. And we were able to conduct multiple vaccine clinics. And it was just terrific work. We were really proud to do it. And we had our patients come back and get their booster shots and continue to booster them even with the waning now, hopefully, of this pandemic. We also realized through this work, and Mike alluded to it and Wendy, about the education component and our students and how important they are to our work. Kate has shared her perspective as somebody with a neurodiversity, and having that perspective really helps inform all of our programs. Specifically, you know, continuing to integrate more and more content around neurodiversity, around intellectual and developmental disability into nursing and medical school curricula. Right now, we're just starting to infuse it. We've worked on a couple different projects to heighten that awareness. We've created some standardized patient simulations. Whereas Dr. Ross said, the first thing we did, we had focus groups with those that have neurodiversity and those folks that work, the frontline workers, the people checking them in, the nurses, the physicians, the occupational therapists, and what they needed, what they were missing in their education to make not only healthcare accessible, but to make it a more satisfactory experience and ultimately to provide safe care and improve those patient outcomes. There was a study that was done last year by Dr. Lisa Iazzoni, who is a physician with a disability herself, and she's out of Harvard University. And it looked at physician perceptions of people with disabilities. And, you know, I'd like to say in our community, it really was a hallmark study for us because it showed us that we have a lot of education to do amongst our own selves as healthcare professionals. 82% of physicians reported that they felt people with disabilities had a worse quality of life than those with non-disability. And I applaud the honesty of the responses on that survey. And what it told me as a healthcare professional is I have work to do. I have work to do educating my nursing community and bringing an awareness to what is needed.
Yeah, Ashley, can you speak to that in the student world? Do you feel like teachers, to Jean's point, like clinicians, like physicians might have a bias for either, you know, to help support if they know or to not support students? Or maybe it's the case where if a student self-identifies before there's a problem, they're more likely to be. So, I mean, could you just speak to this in terms of the university?
I think that stigma with mental health and disability is very real in our society, in the university and outside of the university. And I think that that plays a role in the students who come in and the way that staff or administration look at those students. So I think that sometimes students, for example, are afraid of being stigmatized as having a disability or being on a further end of the neurodiversity spectrum. And so in order to not feel stigmatized, they will not seek out services, or they don't want to. Some students are ashamed to go into counseling center or to sign up for Goal Squared services because of the stigma around doing those things. So I think that that is one part of it. I think the other part is that stigma can come from the other side too. So like professors or staff or administration who don't have a full understanding of how people are different in those ways and how to work with those people can feel intimidated too, and can therefore end up treating those students differently or becoming frustrated or annoyed at something that that student is doing in the classroom without truly understanding what is going on. And I talked about that empathy piece before, but like really all of us can benefit on being able to look at a person with empathy, being able to look at a person and understand who they are and what their story is and what brought them to the place where they are today, that every decision we make is based on those experiences. So as an outsider, for us to place judgment on someone in a negative way, like we don't know someone's whole story or what's happening in their brain.
I would say too that it's also important to recognize that there may be well-intentioned teachers or staff who want to provide support for those individuals, but they don't know how. And so without support themselves, that may contribute to feelings of frustration or this sense of, well, now I have to do, you know, plus one more things to just get through my day. And so not that I think that's necessarily the case in a lot in like Jefferson or a lot of other universities. I think it's probably a more common scenario in like a K through 12 teaching situation. But, you know, it's also important to recognize that supporters need to be supported as well, and that it's this cyclical process. For many people. I mean, it's the same thing when we talk about, there's a lot of dialogue in the healthcare system around like parents, and, you know, parents want to provide the best that they can for their children, but without support and knowledge, skills, those sorts of funding, other, you know, more down-to-earth resources, what they can do is then also limited. And then that changes the outcome. So I think it's a pretty parallel thing that teachers experience at the same time.
Yeah, I think part of what Goal Square does is it helps students deal with some of their own internalized ableism, because like what Ashley said, there is stigma around mental health, there is stigma around neurodiversity, and it can be really challenging for students to share that information with teachers, with classmates, with really anyone. And so part of what we do is we create a safe space and a safe community and interaction where students can explore who they are and what's important to them. And whenever they become more comfortable with who they are and what their needs are, then they're better able to share that with their teachers. Whether or not they share their diagnosis, if they're able to say, I need XYZ, from you, the teacher is going to be much more likely to work with them. And so that's a big part of what we do and how we help to address those challenges.
I have a question, because exactly what you're saying, I've noticed I have a lot of talented students who end up in trouble because of anxiety caused by scheduling or whatever it may be. And they end up being their own worst enemies and not doing what they're capable of doing. And it's very, very upsetting to me, because I see talent, which is being not used as it should be. How do I get these students help?
I think that's a great question, Evan. And I think part of what I hear you asking is like, is this a skill deficit, something they really can't do or don't know how to do or need to be taught, like, you know, as Ashley and Kate would help facilitate? Or mm-hmm. is it a performance deficit? Like, is it something that they know how to do and just aren't doing, you know? So I think that's the struggle that a lot of professors come into it. And I think to, you know, hopefully Kate and Ashley will speak next to more specific interventions. And I guess you can also reach out to them. But I think, you know, two of the themes that are really coming up today are really this idea of a few, you know, empathy, and sort of, you know, not assuming that it's that the student's not trying, but like thinking like, could there be something that they need support with, you know, and maybe it comes down to asking them, right? And then I think the other thing is sort of taking a systems approach, because, you know, to Mike's point, you know, it's not just the students that need support, it's the professors and the teachers like Evan who need to be aware of this and to have this on their radar and to need to have some tools in their pockets So I think it's not just the idea of working with the student or the idea of working with the patient, sort of the identified person or, but really working at a systemic level to really help problem solve here. And I think the other theme I just want to throw out is that there's a sort of universality about this, right? So again, just to go back, it's sort of the kind of thing that some people really have to have, this level of understanding and consciousness that, as Ashley said, we're kind of all on a human spectrum, right? And I think that, but it's this idea that I also have heard come up a few times with a few of our speakers that really there's not anyone who doesn't benefit or might not even transiently have a neurodiversity for whatever reason, but there's really nobody who doesn't benefit from this type of thinking, right? So Ashley and Kate, do you have any more specific suggestions for Evan?
I wanted to add about the idea of reframing how we look at our students. So instead of looking at the student who's like, we feel frustrated, but instead of looking at it as like, oh, they're their own enemy or they're wasting talent, really looking at it as, wow, this is such a smart individual with so much to contribute. And our system isn't set up to operate in a way that supports their unique brain. And that's not a flaw with them. That is a flaw with us, with our system. So rather than thinking like, how can I get this person to change? Flipping the lens back onto ourselves, especially if we're in a teacher role or a support role, and then saying, what do I have to do differently? Because I can see the potential for this person's success. So how do I do something differently to help them reach it? And one thing for any staff or professors at the university, one support here is the Goal Squared program. So really like knowing that that is a resource and being able, if you see a student who is struggling that way, to be able to direct them to that resource on campus could be really effective.
I just want to build on something that Ashley said, which is assume that your students are doing their best, right? So if there's some reason that the student is not fulfilling what they need to fulfill, there's probably a good reason for it, right? So whenever we look at things from a coaching lens, if we're in a coach and coachee relationship, if the client isn't getting somewhere that I feel like they should be getting to, we look at this and say, what can I do as the coach to help get them there, right? Because they're doing their best. In this particular moment, they are absolutely putting in the effort. So figuring out ways to support them and like potentially show empathy, ask the question, you know, what's going on? You know, it seems like you're having a challenge here. How can I help you get there? Right. Which definitely takes more time and effort as the professor. And so I also want to extend empathy there. And we need to support professors more from that perspective. But if you are able to do that, then you're really opening up a door for that student's learning so that you can help them build on their best at that moment.
You know, this whole conversation, sorry to cut you off there, Jane, but I was just reminded that this whole conversation really at the same time dovetails really nicely with the definition and how we think of disability across the board. It really matches up with this notion of disability as defined by the World Health Organization, where it's this incongruence between a person's abilities, the demands of a task, and the environmental context in which they're set. And what's really important about this shift in the framing that Ashley and Kate have put so nicely into words is that it removes the disability from being a thing internal to a person, and it puts it out into this other set of systems. So it's really a shift from this notion of a person has a disability to a person is not functional for some reason. Like they're unable to do a thing because of XYZ. And that gets into a lot of things that the Center for Autism and Neurodiversity focuses on, where we do a lot of work about trying to help develop the skills within a person. There's this remedial approach sometimes, helping a person learn how to do something or to function or manage their own emotions or do whatever that internalized system is. But it's also looking at that environment and the way that we place that person and what that system and context is. And it's also thinking about the task. What is the challenge? And oftentimes we find that the thing that we're asking people to do, we adamantly assert that it must be done this way. And nobody has ever come up and questioned, does it actually have to be done that way? And usually asking that question will get you into trouble, but eventually people admit that, no, it doesn't actually need to be done that way as long as we get to whatever outcome is at the other end. And that sort of mental shift is a really powerful reframing of things. Jane, sorry to cut you off there.
No, Mike, actually it was a perfect segue into some of the thoughts I had while listening to you as well. And it has to do with, you know, we talk about students and disclosing and not disclosing. And as a nurse practitioner, I think about my patients as well. Some of them may realize they have a neurodiversity. A lot of them don't realize they have a deficit in a certain area. As we mentioned earlier, you can go in and out of neurodiversity. If you're receiving chemotherapy, the effects of the medication could cause you to become forgetful and have that brain fog. If you have a significant concussion, you can become neurodivergent for a period of time. And you can also think of it more concrete. People with an intellectual disability, with autism, ADHD, neurodiversity is such a huge umbrella. But it's important when you're working with anybody, whether you're an educator working with the student, whether you're a healthcare provider working with a patient, whether you're the cashier at a store working with a customer in front of you, that you always presume competence with this, with everybody, that because they communicate differently, may take 3 to 4 seconds to respond versus that 1 to 2 seconds. You know, in America, we're so focused on quick responses and moving so quickly and not taking our time. And also coming from that strength-based approach, never looking at the glass as half empty or as a weakness, but what does this person have as a strength? I know in my pediatric patients, when I'm working with them, I always talk to parents and to the kids if they're old enough to understand, what's their strength? What is it they're able to do? These parents, when they come to me, know they're there because maybe their child isn't achieving a milestone, but I don't focus on that. I focus on what they are achieving and what that means and how we can build on it. And I think in general, if we approach everybody in life that way, remember, you know, disability is, you know, a huge, huge umbrella. And people aren't going to say, hey, I'm disabled, you need to do this for me. It's not on them, as Ashley was saying. It's on us to change the culture, to have a culture shift. And I know at the Center for Autism and Neurodiversity, you know, that's the drum we beat every day. We're trying to change the culture. We're just trying to educate and bring awareness and offer a new perspective, a different perspective that involves empathy, that involves advocacy, and just involves caring and thinking about things differently.
I just wanted to say along those lines, one of the things that I find so special about Jefferson, and you can see that even here, is that I feel really so privileged to have met Ashley in preparing for this roundtable and to have met Kate. And I think what's really special is this interdisciplinary perspective. So not only is this systemic, you got to take in the environment, you got to take in the individual, but it's really about how all of us have different mindsets, and not just mindsets, but sort of backgrounds. So, you know, an occupational therapist has their lens, a speech and language pathologist has their lens. And then to Mike's point, like, we have courses in the School of Architecture, Industrial Design, Fashion. And it's really about the thing that's one of the things, one, there's so many things, right? But one of the things that's so special about Jefferson is how we can all come together and really not just problem solve, but really forward think, you know, to prevent or to enhance the world around us by taking each of our own perspectives and bringing them together to have a better product. I mean, it's one thing to go to school to sort of learn your own discipline, but it's another, I think, to learn how to work with other people from different disciplines to really accomplish something innovative. And I just would like to ask our other panelists, like, you know, their thoughts on that as well.
I'll jump in here. You know, in nursing, we're at the bedside. We're working with our patients, and I just gave a class last night talking about this. How important interprofessional collaboration is in healthcare. We can't function in a silo. We're not an island. We have to reach out to our partners and pull them into the care that we provide. You know, healthcare is now going into the community. People are being discharged with far more complex conditions in acute care states, where before they would spend days and weeks in the hospital. We're putting them back into their homes to heal, to get better. But we have to do that with our partners. We've had, you know, I can think of an example at the center where we received a phone call from a nurse working on a floor at the hospital. And they had a patient come in that was neurodiverse. And they had questions regarding how to provide the best care for this patient, how to make them the most comfortable and their family members, and what other team members could they bring in. And we were able to bring in, you know, OT, we were able to bring in speech, we were able to bring in social worker to help with them. Integrative medicine has started to play a huge role in a lot of work we do with the neurodiverse population. So I think, you know, it's really important that we remember to keep a really open mind and think out of the box. And again, it's all about perspectives and sharing those perspectives.
And then on the other side of that, over in the education role within Jefferson, I mean, it's really powerful. And you know, we can't really get enough out of just acknowledging how much there is to do with all of these different disciplines, with all of the humanities, with all of the design departments, with all of the healthcare departments, all of these places that are right next door to each other between all of these different campuses, and how with just a simple email, a simple introduction, a simple conversation, we're able to brainstorm and really bring together so many different people and skill sets and ideas together for a more positive outcome, for a bigger, better thing that is greater than the sum of its parts. I've been, in my years at Jefferson, I have been a part of many different interdisciplinary projects. In fact, it's much rarer for me to be part of a project that is, say, only occupational therapy or like only medicine or something like that, than it is for me to be on something where there's 3, 4, 6 different departments and teams represented, at least in some capacity. And, you know, it's been the thing where organically these relationships grow and opportunities come out of one another where somebody wants to do something. There's so much interest in working with neurodiverse populations or with getting healthcare perspectives in design or design perspectives into healthcare or what have you, that all of these things just grow and bubble together in such a refreshing, organic way. I think just about every project or partnership that I have been a part of has been something that has just sprouted like branches off of a tree from one project or one relationship into another, which I think is a really powerful part of just the Jefferson experience and our mindset and all the things that are happening between the different campuses, whether they're medical or educational.
If I can just come in for a second, I recognize the Gold Square office because it's right across from mine at the Spector Center. And how, again, talking as practically as I can, for students I know would benefit from your program, which I'm hearing in detail for the first time, very excited about. How do I get that student over from my office across the living room over to your office on the other side? How do I get them the help I think they would really benefit from?
You can walk on over anytime. We can also send you information about, we have a sign up link where students can schedule on our calendar. They can see our availability, and you could also put them in touch with us via text or email. So I'll make sure that we share all that information.
If you can send me, you can send me just an email with that, I would greatly appreciate it. I'll be crossing over the living room a little bit more than I have been.
Great. It'll be good to see you. I was going to add, to answer your question, Wendy, too, that we are in our program often thinking about what are the different offices on campus and how could we partner with them. So I'll give one example. The first one that's coming to my mind, a couple of years ago, it might have been you, Mike, who did a presentation to the safety and security
officer. Yes, it was.
Yeah, about how to support neurodiverse individuals in an emergency. So we did that. A lot of times we'll partner with the counseling center about providing mindfulness-based workshops or support-based workshops to students from both the Goal Squared and the counseling program. And we kind of always try to think about, like, we have a list of all of the offices that we'll look at every semester and just think about, like, what are the opportunities here? How can we explore and partner and connect with these different people on campus?
I think, you know, that, you know, just to sort of start to wrap us up and, you know, maybe if each of us has a closing comment, but I think, you know, what Ashley, you just said is it's really about opportunity, right? And it's really about framing things of how we can leverage people's strengths to help them with areas of challenge. What are alternative ways we can have them demonstrate their mastery of material, whether it be in the classroom or whether it be, you know, in a hospital, you know, in accessing a hospital setting. And I think what this is really about, again, just to emphasize, is just the universal need for this type of empathy and perspective taking and framing of situations, right? And so anyway, if anybody else wants to add any closing remarks before we finish, go for it.
I would just like to add that, you know, I work with students and I work with patients, and I don't always have the answer, and I would never want to think I always had the answer, but I ask. And just remembering to ask somebody, is there an easier way I could do something that would be more helpful to you? Or what do you prefer, rather than assuming? And it's such a simple thing just to ask a question of somebody and what they prefer, that I think we just sometimes overlook it and we think it should be more complicated than that, but it's not. So with that empathetic thought in mind, if you see somebody struggling, or if you're feeling frustrated, if you're feeling like you're not providing the care you want to, or you're not communicating clearly enough, asking that person, could I be doing something differently? As Ashley said, put it back on yourself. What is it that I'm not doing to meet your needs? So again, if you can remember one thing, it's okay to ask, and you're going to get a lot of great information back.
And I'm just going to segue right off of that. For any of the professionals or businesses or community members, departments within Jefferson, departments without Jefferson, you know, whoever you are, it's okay. Just ask. If you have an interest, if you have a question, if you feel like you need some support, reach out to us. Reach out to the Jefferson Center for Autism and Neurodiversity. Reach out to Goal Squared. Reach out to one of us. And as Jane said, we might not always have the answer right off the top of our heads, but we'll work with you. We'll talk. We'll have a conversation. That's what we do. That's how we spread and create these organic relationships. And that's how we do all of this great work, is by being open and having these experiences with other people.
Yeah, just both on what both of you have said about how the ability to give yourself grace to ask these questions and practice empathy is is a skill set. And so it's okay to realize that maybe you or I or any of us need to practice these skills. And intentionally taking the time to cultivate that, to surround yourself with people who are also practicing that, so you can build on those skills and create this better community, this more empathetic community that we all want to work on, is a wonderful gift to give.
I'll add and echo everyone's sentiments. I think a lot of times people are looking for this cookie cutter approach. Like, tell me the scheduling template that's going to work for people with ADHD, or tell me the communication tips that are going to work for everyone with autism. And we really want those things, because a lot of times in physical health, it's a little more like that, at least in occupational therapy. These exercises are good for someone who had hip surgery, X, Y, and Z. But in mental health, in the neurodiversity spectrum, it's not a cookie cutter approach. There's no this one template or this one thing works for everyone. The thing that we're all saying that does consistently work for everyone is empathy and unconditional positive regard. when we can have those things, then we can figure out what the intervention is for that individual person. That's going to be totally different from the intervention for the next individual person who walks through our door.
So what I'm also hearing, just to add on, is really about having flexibility, right? So it's flexibility in how we problem solve, flexibility in how we identify solutions, and flexibility in how we see situations, you know, which is one of the reasons, just in conclusion, that we're so grateful, Evan, to you for having us here today to help, you know, just bring some of these issues to people's minds. Because, you know, to what I also hear everybody say is that it's not really about having the answers. It's really about thinking about different kinds of questions.
Well, I want to thank everybody. This was very helpful, especially to me, because I'll be using more of these services that I really wasn't aware as much as I should have been. And now I think because of this roundtable, not only myself, but other professors who I will send this to will be aware of these great services that you folks offer. And I really do appreciate you coming today. And thank you all very much for appearing. And at this point, I will go off the air and say, have a good rest of the time off for those of you who have time off this week.